This lecture was originally given on Friday evening, February 22nd, 2008, at the Young Israel of Avenue J. It is lecture 2 in the series Maintaining Orthodoxy in the New World. Since I received a number of requests from people who would like to hear this lecture but could not attend on Friday evening, I am recording it today on a Sunday. Lecture 2 deals with the period 1700 to 1800. It covers the topics Colonial Jewish Communities, Savannah, Dr. Samuel Nunez, Escape from the Inquisition, Newport, Aaron Lopez, Rebecca Mercado and Jonas Phillips, Rebecca Samuels, Jews in the Revolutionary War, Chaim Solomon, and Israel Bear Kirschig. One has to understand what the Jews who were living in Spain and Portugal under the Inquisition went through. They lived in constant fear of being caught by the Inquisition and tried. They tried to maintain the secret practice of Judaism much as possible. For example, some of them went to the extent of eating matzah all year round so that they could eat matzah on Pesach. They claimed that bread did not agree with them and they could not digest it, and therefore they ate matzah the entire year. Children of Morano families were not told that they were Jewish until the ages of 12 or so, because they were afraid that young children might, quote-unquote, spill the beans. Morano families, or conversos as they're also known as, married only within certain families. In truth, they knew little about Judaism. They had no access to a Jewish calendar. And just to understand how far and how long the Inquisition went, Jews were burnt at the stake in Portugal into the latter part of the 18th century. Now, the Jews who came to America towards the latter part of the 17th century and in the 18th century did not just come from Spain and Portugal. From the beginning of the 18th century, Jews began coming from England, Germany, and Poland. There were five major Jewish communities besides New York in America. They were Newport, Philadelphia, Charleston, Savannah, and Richmond, Virginia. They were all founded by Sephardim. And the Nusach in the synagogues in these communities was all the Spanish-Portuguese Nusach. Despite the fact that already by around 1700, the Ashkenazim outnumbered the Sephardim. We're going to discuss a number of key people who lived during this time. The first person is Dr. Samuel Nunez. Actually, his name was originally Diego Nunez Ribeiro. He was born in 1668, and he married Gracia Rebecca de Sequeira, who was born in 1678. Neither of their names sound very Jewish to us, and that is because they were both baptized by the Catholic Church and had Catholic names. Dr. Nunez was an exceptionally talented physician, and he served the court of the king in Lisbon in Portugal. However, he was accused of being a secret Judaizer, and he and his family were indeed convicted of this and were put in prison. However, since he had such extensive medical knowledge, his talents were needed by the court, and he was released from prison with his family, but on the following condition. Two spies from the church were required to live with his family constantly and make sure that the family did not practice any Jewish rituals. One can imagine how difficult life must have been for the Nunez family. And indeed, Dr. Nunez was determined to escape from Portugal if possible, and he devised a plan. He made contact in some way or other with a ship captain from London and arranged that when the ship came to Portugal and docked in the river nearby, the estate, and Dr. Nunez had a very large estate in Lisbon, that the ship's captain would invite the family to dine on the ship. On that day that the ship docked, Dr. Nunez sponsored a rather gala party, and then at lunchtime, he and his family, together with the spies, boarded the ship in order to have lunch. While they were eating lunch below deck, the ship pulled up anchor and sailed to London. So the entire family, together with the spies, ended up in London. Now, the family knew that they were going to try this escape, and therefore the women had sewn their precious diamonds and jewels into their dresses, and the men had taken as much as possible in terms of material assets. When Dr. Nunes arrived in London, he did what virtually all of the Muranos did when they got to a place where they could practice Judaism openly. He circumcised himself. He had himself circumcised. He remarried his wife according to halacha, and he and his wife took Jewish names. Dr. Nunes was amongst the first Jews to arrive in Savannah, Georgia on July 11, 1733. His wife followed him on November 12, 1733. When Dr. Nunes arrived in July of 1773 in Savannah, there was an epidemic going on. And given that he was a talented physician, he was able to propose certain measures that ended up stemming the epidemic. James Oglethorpe was the governor of the colony, and he wanted to reward Dr. Nunes and his party by giving them tracts of land. However, he was not sure if he should do this. So he sent letters to the parent company in England asking them what he should do. But at the same time, he asked a lawyer who represented the parent company, who was located in Charleston, could he give the Jews land? The response was that Catholics are not allowed to own land. There's nothing against Jews. So he gave them tracts of land in Savannah. However, somewhat later, he got a letter from the parent company saying that he should in no way give any land to the Jews, but he had already done it. So in a certain sense, the Jews who came to Savannah suffered just the opposite fate of the Jews who came to New York. When the Jews came to New York, the governor, who was then New Amsterdam, Peter Stuyvesant, tried to kick them out, whereas the parent company said no, they must stay here. The governor allowed them to stay, whereas the parent company wanted them to leave. Dr. Nunes and his wife had six children. One daughter was Maria Catena Tzipora. It was her Hebrew name. She was born in 1714. Tzipora married Reverend David Mendez Mercado, who was a chazan in Sherith Israel. David Mercado had himself escaped from Portugal, grew up under the Inquisition, and in an astounding manner managed to master enough of Judaism within the short time that he was here in America that he was able to serve as the Chazan. They had a daughter, Rebecca, who was born in 1746. The Inquisition had made such an impression on Tzipora, her mother, Rebecca's mother, that Rebecca reported that her mother said a special prayer every time the clock struck the hour, thanking Hashem for their deliverance from the Inquisition. Rebecca married Jonas Phillips in 1762. In 1762, at the age of 16, Rebecca married Jonas Phillips. He was born in 1735 and died in 1803, who was 11 years her senior. Phillips, of Ashkenazic descent, was born in Rhenish, Prussia, but had been reared in London. He must have received a better-than-average Jewish education, since he was trained as a shochet. For Jonas, marriage to Rebecca would have symbolized social upward mobility, since Sfardim were associated with nobility and culture. Conversely, many 18th-century Sfardim scorned German Jews as, quote, ill-bred and uncouth, unquote. These attitudes help to explain the fact that until the early 1800s, all American congregations followed the Sephardic rite, although by around 1730, Ashkenazim were more numerous than Sephardim in a number of cities, including New York. Shortly after their marriage, Rebecca and her husband moved to New York, where Jonas resumed his activities as a businessman. By the next autumn, Rebecca had given birth to the first of their, pay attention now, 21 children. She had 21 children. Of the 21, probably 16 survived into adulthood. In addition to childbearing and child raising, Rebecca, like most 18th century women, manufactured cloth, clothing, soap, candles, and prepared processed comestibles to serve as their winter food supply. The members of the Jonas family were, of course, observant Jews. Rebecca supervised her kitchen to make sure that all was done according to halacha. Naftali Taylor Phillips, family historian, direct descendant of Rebecca, wrote in 1927, "No matter how well off they were, how rich they were, whether they were Gomez or Mercado, or who they were, the women either did the cooking themselves or superintended it. It was not left to the slaves or to the Negroes. If it was, it was a trefa house, that is, the house that permitted the servants exclusively to run the kitchen. People would not eat there, and therefore the woman of the house either had to do it herself or had to be on the job and see that it was properly done. If she had a lot of servants, she directed them or could give the final okay that everything was according to Hoyle, but she had to be there personally. During the last 10 years of her childbearing years, if not earlier, Rebecca began to adopt an active role in both Jewish and non-Jewish public affairs. In 1801, at the age of 55, Rebecca was one of the founding members of the Female Association for the Relief of Women and Children in Reduced Circumstances. This Philadelphia organization, the Jonas family had relocated to Philadelphia, in which Gentile and Jewish women joined efforts, was dedicated to assisting yellow fever victims in Baltimore, supporting a soup house for the poor, and generally providing food and clothing to indigent women and children. Only 2 years later, Rebecca was widowed, leaving her a single mother of as many as 16 children. She was 57 at the time. Rebecca's personal piety and dedication to her people shone particularly during her widowed years. In 1820, at the age of 74, Rebecca, now widowed for 17 years, served as first directress and one of 13 managers serving on the board of the Female Hebrew Benevolent Society of Philadelphia. The society, founded in 1819 to assist the Jewish indigent, was the first non-synagogue-related charitable society in America. We have, interestingly enough, a description of the chasana of one of the daughters of Rebecca and Jonas Phillips. Dr. Benjamin Rush, a Gentile, was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was a physician who lived in Philadelphia, and he was the family physician of the Jonases. He was invited in 1787 to attend the chasana of one of the Jonases, the Phillipses' children. And he was a prolific writer, recorded virtually everything that happened to him, and we have a letter that he wrote to his wife about attending the chasana. What's interesting is to see what he writes, to read what he writes. I wrote an article about this, which is available on the Jewish Press website, called A 1787 Wedding. There he comments that the people talked during the chuppah. So apparently not too much has changed over the years. Rebecca Phillips embodies both the exceptional and the mundane. Her duties as wife and mother are typical of the colonial and early American experience. Yet these duties must be considered extraordinary, for they were carried out as Rebecca bore 21 children away and raised two of her grandchildren, exceeding the account of even the largest known American Jewish families in her time. Rebecca Mercado Phillips's grandson was Mordechai Manuel Noah, and he and his sister had been orphaned at an early age, and Rebecca and Jonas took them in and raised them along with their 21 children. Rebecca's pioneering activities as a communal activist and philanthropist in both the Jewish and non-Jewish communities were extraordinary for her time. Yet these endeavors would be considered by the end of the 19th century not only the common domain of the American woman, but increasingly and in many important respects her natural domain. Rebecca's pioneering exceptionalism thus foreshadowed that which would soon become commonplace. We now turn to Aaron Lopez. He was considered a colonial merchant prince. He was born in 1731. His birth name was Duarte. He managed to escape with his wife and daughter from the Inquisition in Portugal, and he came to Newport in 1752. Now, I attended a few years ago an exhibition at the American Jewish Historical Society called 350 Years of American Jewish History. And there one sees a portrait of Aaron Lopez. And by the way, he's clean shaven. He doesn't have a yarmulke on. He doesn't look Jewish. But that's the way they looked in those days. It mentions that Lopez was an extremely wealthy merchant. In fact, he was probably the most successful merchant during colonial times before the Revolutionary War. But something that the exhibit does not mention is the fact that Aaron Lopez was a Shomer Shabbos. When he came to Newport in 1752, he changed his name from Duarte to Aaron. He was circumcised. He remarried his wife Kehalacha. And he was an observant Jew. We have letters. We have the letter of someone who wrote that I would like to meet with you on such and such a day. I had hoped to, but I was told that you will not be doing any business because it is your holiday. It was actually Pesach. Aaron was very involved in the Toro Synagogue. In fact, he laid. He was one of the founders of the Toro Synagogue. His ships did not sail on Shabbos from Newport. He wouldn't unload them on Shabbos. He shipped kosher meat to the Caribbean, kosher cheese. He had a very large family. When his son Yosef was born, of course he wanted his son to have a bris milah. And he called upon Abram I. Abrahams. Now Abrahams traveled as far north as Rhode Island in the performance of his craft. By the way, Abrahams was a rarity in colonial America because he was a Lithuanian Jew. Almost no Jews from Lithuania came to America during this period. It is doubtful that Abrahams was paid for performing this religious privilege. More likely, he did so out of devotion. In June 1756, he was then 36, he began to chronicle his work as a moel in New York City. His first recorded circumcision was that of his own son, Isaac. He was to grow up, not as his father had prayed, to the study of the Jewish law, but to become a New York physician. Isaac Abrahams, in fact, was the only Jewish graduate of King's College, which later became Columbia College, prior to the American Revolution. Less than 2 months after Isaac Abrahams was circumcised, his father was called upon to make a trip to Newport, Rhode Island, at the invitation of a young businessman by the name of Aaron Lopez. However, it was not easy for Abrahams to get to Newport, and also he had other business obligations, etc., and he didn't get there until 6 months later. So Yosef Lopez had to wait 6 months before his bris milah. During the Revolutionary War, and Aaron, of course, sided with the revolutionary movement, he and his relatives, most of the Jews, in fact, of Newport, fled from Newport, and he and his father-in-law went to Leicester, Massachusetts. That's where they spent the Revolutionary War. The chronicler, the town chronicler of Leicester, Massachusetts, wrote 70 years after Lopez had been there that he and his father-in-law kept their businesses closed not only on Sunday, but also on Saturday. Aaron Lopez began to return in 1782 to Newport because the war was over. On his return, his horse, for some reason or other, went into some sort of a pond or lake. He pursued the horse, and he himself unfortunately drowned trying to get his horse back. What kind of a man was Aaron Lopez? What sort of a Jew was Aaron? He lived in the world of 18th century American Sephardic Orthodoxy, and simultaneously in the world of the 18th century Gentile milieu. He belonged as much to the one as to the other, and he appears to have been conscious of no inevitable conflict between the two. All who knew him agree, wrote a Massachusetts journalist shortly after Aaron's death, that he was, in the fullest import of the words, a good citizen and an honest man. Nearly all we know or can surmise of Aaron's life lends substance to this observation. Now, Ezra Stiles, who eventually was involved with Yale, lived in Newport at the time that Aaron Lopez did. And he knew Aaron Lopez, and he wrote after Aaron Lopez passed away, that he believed him to have been without a single enemy and the most universally beloved by an extensive acquaintance of any man I have ever knew. I'm reading the way he wrote, the way Stiles wrote. Aaron's beneficence to his family and connections to his nation, the Jews, and to all the world is almost without parallel. Such was the buena fama of Aaron Lopez. Jews struggled to maintain religious observance in the New World during the 18th century. We have two letters from a woman by the name of Rebecca Samuels. She and her family lived in Petersburg, Virginia. Apparently, Petersburg, Virginia was some sort of a crossroads for business, etc., and there was a small Jewish community there. Rebecca wrote on January 12, 1791, a letter to her family, or to her parents, who were still in Europe. She wrote, "Dear and worthy parents, I received your dear letter with much pleasure and therefrom understand that you are in good health, thank God. And that made us especially happy. The same is not lacking with us. May we live to be 100 years. Amen. We are completely isolated here. We do not have any friends, and when we do not hear from you for any length of time, it is enough to make us sick. I hope that I will get to see some of my family. That will give me some satisfaction. You write me that Mr. Jacob Renner's son, Reuven, is in Philadelphia and that he will come to us. People will not advise him to come to Virginia. When the Jews of Philadelphia, New York hear the name Virginia, they get nasty. And they are not wrong. It won't do for a Jew. In the first place, it is an unhealthful district, and we are only human. God forbid, if anything should happen to us, where would we be thrown? There is no cemetery in the whole of Virginia. In Richmond, which is 22 miles from here, there is a Jewish community consisting of two quorums, that is 20 men, and the two cannot muster a minyan in order where they can daven. Rebecca Samuel." A second letter from Petersburg, Virginia, sometime after 1791. "Dear parents, I hope my letter will ease your mind. You can now be reassured and send me one of the family to Charleston, South Carolina." Charleston, South Carolina, by the way, had a vibrant Jewish community. In fact, at one point, Charleston, South Carolina had more Jews than New York. "This is the place to which, with God's help, we will go after Passover. The whole reason why we are leaving this place is because of its lack of Yehudishkeit." She called it Yehudishkeit. "Dear parents, I know quite well you will not want me to bring up my children like Gentiles. Here we cannot become anything else. Jewishness is pushed aside here. There are here in Petersburg 10 or 12 Jews, and they are not worthy of being called Jews. We have a shochet here who goes to market and buys treif meat and then brings it home. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the people worshipped here without one sefer Torah. And not one of them wore the talis or the arba kanfos except Hyman," that's her husband, "and my Sammy's godfather. You can believe me that I crave to see a synagogue to which I can go. The way we live now is no life at all. We do not know what the Sabbath and the holidays are. On the Sabbath, all the Jewish shops are open, and they do business on that day as they do throughout the whole week. But ours we do not allow to open. With us there is still some Sabbath. You can believe me that in our house, we all live as Jews as much as we can. All the people who hear that we are leaving give us their blessings. They say that it is sinful that such blessed children should be brought up here in Petersburg. My children cannot learn anything here, nothing Jewish, nothing of Gentile culture. My Shana, her daughter, God bless her, is already 3 years old. I think it is time that she should learn something, and she has a good head to learn. I have taught her the bedtime prayers and grace after meals in just two lessons. I believe that no one among the Jews here can do as well as she. And my Sammy, that's her son, born in 1790, God bless him, is already beginning to talk. I could write more, however, I do not have any more paper. I remain your devoted daughter and servant, Rebecca, the wife of Chaim, the son of Samuel the Levi. The letter is filled with pathos, is filled with desire to be able to practice Judaism, but the environment in which they lived was virtually impossible to overcome. As far as the Jews in the Revolutionary War, most Jews sided with the colonies. It was only natural that they should side with the colonies, because most of the Jews were merchants and they were quite unhappy about the financial interference of the British into their business. A few Jews, just to mention that, who were sided with the revolutionary cause. One is Gershon Mendesheishis, that's S-E-I-X-A-S, Sheishis it's pronounced. He was the Chazan in Sheret Israel in New York. And most of the Jews of New York City fled to Philadelphia during the Revolutionary War when it became clear that the British were going to capture New York. He lived out the war in Philadelphia. Worthy of mention also is a gentleman named of Moses or Moshe Mordechai and his son Jacob Mordechai. Moshe Mordechai served in the Continental Army, and his son Jacob, at the age of maybe 14 or 15, also served. The Schefftels of Savannah were patriots who fought for the Revolutionary War cause. There were some Jews who sided with the British. One of them was Isaac Turo. He was the Chazan of the Newport, Rhode Island synagogue. At the end of the Revolutionary War, when the British were defeated, Turo was devastated. He was completely penniless, and he ended up going to Jamaica, where he died about a year after he got there. Something worth mentioning is a small island in the Caribbean called St. Eustatius, or Statia. Today it is controlled by the Dutch. Statia, or St. Eustatius, served as a supply port for the Revolutionary Army. The Jews there were very active in sending goods to the colonies. It's interesting that I wrote an article about St. Eustatius, also it's available on the Jewish Press website, and that article was picked up by the St. Martin's Daily Herald, a newspaper in an island nearby St. Eustatius. I received a request from somebody at the paper asking if they could republish the article in their Sunday paper, which they eventually did. They did it in a beautiful layout with a Star of David in behind the article in blue and white with my picture, and then they had pictures of the remains of the synagogue in St. Eustatius. The Queen of Holland had visited. They had a picture of her. Very nice article. Let's say a little bit about Chaim Solomon, 1740 to 1785. Somebody once said to me, the only thing that I learned in yeshiva about American Jewish history is that Chaim Solomon financed the revolution. I looked at him and I said, sorry, my friend, but this is probably not true. In fact, Chaim Solomon did not finance the revolution. He did not have the money to finance the revolution. What he did do was loan money to prominent Americans in the government, such as Madison, and he served as a financial agent. He did a great deal to raise funds to support the revolution. But he himself could not and did not finance the revolution. I refer you to the article that I wrote that's on the Jewish Press website under my column Glimpses in American Jewish History, in which I talk about the fact of Chaim Solomon and the American Revolution. I got an email from a woman not long ago. By the way, this is one of the amazing things about the internet. The internet certainly has its problems, do not get me wrong. But on the other hand, it is alive in the sense that you never know who will pick up an article that's posted and write to you about it. A woman wrote to me a couple of weeks ago that her daughter had been taught that Chaim Soloman financed, she wasn't sure whether it was the revolution or the civil war, and she wanted to know, her daughter wanted to know, how observant was he? Well, I explained to her that he died in 1785, so he certainly did not finance the Civil War. It was the Revolutionary War, but he really didn't finance the Revolutionary War. Now, how frum was he? How observant was he? I wrote her back, this I can assure you. He did not wear his tzitzis out. That's for sure. Now, I really don't know exactly how observant he was, but let me tell you a story that gives an insight into him. There lived in Philadelphia in the 1780s, a gentleman named Jacob I. Cohen. He was a Kohen. And there also lived a woman by the name of Esther Elizabeth Whitlock Mordechai. Why such a long name? Well, Esther Whitlock was a Gentile woman who converted to Judaism in England and married a gentleman named Moshe Mordechai, whom we mentioned a bit earlier. When she converted, she was known as Esther. They came here to the colonies, and they had three children. One of them was Jacob Mordechai, whom we'll talk about in the next lecture. He was famous for his female academy. Esther and Mordechai and Moshe, I think, were married in England. They came here. They had three sons. When Moshe Mordechai passed away, Jacob wanted to marry her. There's a problem, though. She's a Gioris, and a Kohen cannot marry a Gioris. They went to the Philadelphia synagogue and asked to be married in the synagogue by the Chazan. The presidium of the synagogue absolutely forbade it. Under no circumstances, they told the Chazan, was he to preside at such a wedding, and they would not allow the wedding to take place in the synagogue. Nonetheless, they did marry. And we have the ksuva that was used at their chasana. In it, it says Yaakov HaKohen, and it mentions Esther HaGioris. And who was one of the witnesses who signed on that ksuva? None other than Chaim Soloman. Let's turn now to an unusual person in colonial times. Yisrael Ber Kershit, 1766 to 1852. The sources for the information about Kershit's life are the Asmonean. That was a newspaper that was written in English, a Jewish newspaper that appeared in the middle of the 19th century, and Isaac Leeser's Occident. This is a English publication, again, that appeared in the 19th century. Now, one has to understand that early American Jewry had no ordained rabbis that stayed here for any length of time. Indeed, from 1654 until 1840, no ordained Orthodox rabbi resided permanently in America. The first Orthodox rabbi to come to America was Rabbi Abraham Rice. He came in 1840. He went to Baltimore, and in Baltimore he found total chaos in the Jewish community of Baltimore. We'll talk about him in the next lecture. Who led the Jewish community during this period until 1840? They were primarily Chazanim and some better educated Balabatim, some Moalim, and certain businessmen who had a better than average Torah education. But the level of Torah knowledge was so low that many European communities would not accept a get or a gioris from America. There was one Talmud Chacham who resided here before 1800, and his name is Yisrael Ber Kershit. Kershit was born in Singhaven, Germany, near the Rhine, on the fourth day of Pesach in 5526. That's April 6th, 1766. He was orphaned at a young age, and his mother relocated to Kershit near Königswinter. And that's where he got his last name. Jews in Germany did not in general have last names. He took the last name of the place where he had resided. As a youth, he showed a brilliance in learning, and he was sent to the yeshiva of Nosson Adler. Rav Nosson Adler's 1741 to 1800. The yeshiva was located in Frankfurt. And Yisrael Ber Kershit studied in this yeshiva for a number of years. The most famous student of Rav Nosson Adler is Rav Moshe Schreiber, the Chassam Sofer, 1762 to 1839. Kershit was a good student. Among Yisrael Ber Kershit's fellow students were two who particularly distinguished themselves and attained considerable eminence. Rav Avram Bing, 1742-1841, and Rav Wolf Heidenheim, 1757-1832. Rav Bing became the chief rabbi of Würzburg. His students included Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Rav Nathan Marcus Adler, Chacham Isaac Barnes, and Rav Selig Ber Bamberger. These, ladies and gentlemen, are no small names. These are big people. Rav Heidenheim is known for his many literary publications, including a Hebrew commentary on and a German translation of the Machzor. Indeed, he is the person behind what is known as the famous Reudelheim Machzor. According to the above cited articles from the Asmoni and the Occident, Rav Nosson Adler held these three students in equal estimation. Rav Adler used to say that Rav Avram was a charif, an acute logician, Rav Wolf a medaktik, a grammarian and a philologist, and Rav Yisrael a chochem, a wise man whose accomplishments in Torah learning were universal. So we see that Rav Yisrael Ber Kershit was indeed a Talmud chochem. His studies were interrupted in 1792 by the French Revolution. General Adam Custine invaded Frankfurt in 1792, and the students were scattered. Frankfurt had a beautiful park, which was off limits to Jews. Jews could not set foot in the park. When Napoleon's army arrived under General Custine, one of the officers asked a Jew where might be a good place for the troops to camp. The Jew, remembering that the Jews were banned from the park, suggested that the army camp within the park. The net result was that this beautiful park was devastated. What was Yisrael Ber Kershit to do now that he had to leave the yeshiva? He, in some way or other, managed to become a supplier to the Prussian army. He got a contract with the Prussian army. How a sheltered yeshiva boy was able to do this, I do not know. After all, there was danger dealing with Gentile military men. The peace in 1795 ended his business of supplying the Prussian army, so Yisrael Ber Kershit decided to leave Germany. The conditions for Jews in Germany were not good. They had to pay special taxes. If they wanted to cross a bridge, they had to pay a tax. All sorts of restrictions. He went to Hamburg with the idea of boarding a ship and going to London, England. However, when he got there, he found that there was a ship that was going to Boston. He had heard that there was a Jewish community there. So he booked passage on the Simenhof. That's a small 70 to 80 ton vessel. The passage from Europe to Boston took 70 days. Now here's a man, Rabbi Yisrael, who spoke no English. He couldn't communicate with the people on the ship. He was on the ship for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and I presume Sukkot also. So how did he communicate with the captain to make it clear to the captain when it was a Jewish holiday or something? Well, he knew the chapter and verse in which the holidays were discussed. He was able, apparently, to read the Roman numerals. So he would point out to the captain the verses dealing, say, with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The captain was very cooperative and did his best to assist him to observe Yom Tovim. He arrived in Boston at the end of 1796, and he discovered that the entire Jewish community of Boston consisted of only one Jewish family. As a result, he left for New York shortly thereafter. When he arrived in New York, there was also a small number of Jews in New York. According to the rise of the Jewish community of New York by Hyman B. Greenstein, the Jewish population of New York in 1695 numbered 100 Jews, in 1750, 300, in 1794, 350, in 1809, 450, in 1815, 350, in 1820, 450, in 1825, 500 Jews, and in 1836 it went up to 2,000. So there really were a very small number of Jews living in New York at the time that Yisrael Ber got there. Yisrael Ber's first impressions of Jewish life in New York must have left him crestfallen. In material terms, the Jewish community consisted of a synagogue building on Mill Street, dating back to 1730, an adjoining chevra meeting place and schoolhouse, the minister's house, and a cemetery on Chatham Square. Its upkeep was the cause of frequent outbreaks, that is, disagreements among the trustees of Sheret Israel. Until 1825, it would be the only Jewish cemetery in New York City. They, that is, the Jews of New York, knew little of Jewish traditions. Neglect, apathy, and petty bickering were pervasive. So you see, things really have not changed very much in the Jewish community. Now, Gershom Mendeshatius, 1745 to 1816, whom we spoke about a little bit earlier, and who had been appointed Chazan of Sheret Israel Synagogue at the age of 23, was at that time the Chazan of the Sheret Israel Synagogue. He was not a rabbi. He served for almost 50 years as a Chazan. He's known as the Patriotic Chazan. Again, as we mentioned earlier, because he fled from New York to Philadelphia during the Revolutionary War, and because he supported the Revolutionary War. He quickly made the acquaintance of Yisrael Ber Kershid, and he was able to appreciate the value of Kershid's extensive Torah knowledge. On January 18, 1804, Kershid married Sarah Abigail Sally Shatius. She's 1778 to 1854, the eldest daughter of Chazan Shatius. Sarah was the favorite child of Reverend Shatius, and Yisrael Ber became his favorite son-in-law. In New York, Yisrael Ber went into business. Quote, he had his share of both prosperity and of adversity, like all other men. But the one never rendered him arrogant, the other could not cast him down. There were in his character two remarkable traits that still kept him upright and enabled him to preserve the serenity of his mind. Trust in God and a good opinion of men. He was incapable of believing in the bad intentions of others. And though he, more than once or twice, suffered severely from his confidence being abused, he could not be persuaded that the cause was other than imprudence or folly on the part of those through whom he suffered. His trust in God was firm and not to be shaken, as it sprung from his profound conviction of the truth of his religion and consequently in the wisdom and goodness of Providence. This is a quote from the Asmonean. As a man with a growing family, it was only natural for Yisrael Ber to become involved in the Jewish education offered by Yeshivat Minchat Arab, which Sheret Israel had established in 1731. He believed strongly that Jewish education was the first thing that ought to be pursued in life. With this goal, he worked diligently to expand the curriculum of this yeshiva. However, the yeshiva suffered from the fact that it was virtually impossible to get qualified instructors. You couldn't find rebbes to teach. In 1808, Yisrael Ber Kershid was appointed to a committee of six to draft a detailed proposal and regulations for the reorganization of the yeshiva into a real Jewish day school for boys and girls. Ladies and gentlemen, is not true the propaganda that you have heard that Sarishnero was the first to implement education for girls. Here we have this in 1808 for girls, probably even earlier. I was told by a friend of mine that in 1840, Rav Shamshir Fulhirsch wrote a letter to someone in Poland outlining how he should set up a school for girls. There were, in Frankfurt itself, in Hirsch's real shul, there were special classes, there were separate classes for boys and girls. In any case, this yeshiva that was attached to Sheret Israel, the school remained active until 1822. Its aims, as articulated by Yisrael Ber, were 1, to instruct students in religion and morality; 2, to make sure their actions are in harmony with these teachings; and 3, to impress on their minds the excellence of our belief. In 1810, in recognition of his service to the Jewish community, Yisrael Ber Kershid was elected Parnes, that is, president of Sheret Israel, and served for 1 term. Yisrael Ber fought many battles at Sheret Israel. Not all were victorious, especially in matters involving ingrained customs. In 1809, he and other forward-minded congregants attempted to restrict Mishaberach prayers made on behalf of individuals called to the Torah, for which it was customary to make a donation to the synagogue to 3 per person. The plan was not adopted. In 1812, Yisrael Be'er and his family relocated to Richmond, Virginia. He was convinced that there were better opportunities in business for him there. He served as the chazan of the synagogue there. While there, he met Isaac Leiser, who, as we show here in the next lecture, was in the forefront of everything Jewish in the 19th century. He also had contact with Jacob Mordechai, who was famous for his female academy in Warrenton, North Carolina. While residing in Virginia, Yisrael Be'er Khurshid became acquainted with Thomas Jefferson and even visited him on more than one occasion at Monticello. He returned to New York in 1824. At this point, he had 9 children, so he was a family of 11. New York's Jewish community had changed a great deal in the 12 years the Khurshids had lived in Richmond. The majority of the Jewish community was now of Ashkenazic background, and they were unhappy with the Spanish-Portuguese, the Sephardic ritual of Shevet Israel, the only synagogue in the city. In 1825, in an attempt at compromise, Yisrael Be'er organized a separate Ashkenaz minyan at the synagogue. The leaders of the congregation, however, refused to let the minyan continue, and Congregation B'nai Yeshurun, New York's second oldest congregation, which followed the Ashkenazic ritual, was established that same year. This was the first Ashkenazic shul in North America. In about 1834, Yisrael Be'er Khurshid played a key role in the establishment of the Chevra Trumas HaKodesh, which aided the poor of Israel. On April 19, 1840, he chaired a gathering of New York's Jewish community to protest the Damascus Affair. Now, what was the Damascus Affair? When a Franciscan friar and his Muslim servant disappeared, the Jews of Damascus were accused of having killed them to use their blood for Jewish Passover rites, a blood libel. A number of Damascus Jews were arrested and tortured to make them, quote-unquote, confess to the crime. Some Jews died. Even Jewish children were taken prisoner. Let's talk a little bit about the last days of Yisrael Be'er Khurshid. Hyman Grinstein writes in his book, The Rise of the Jewish Community of New York, Yisrael Be'er Khurshid, whose rabbinical knowledge was undoubtedly outstanding in the city in the first half of the 19th century, was a retiring person who rarely went out of his way to make his influence felt in the community. When he was approached on legal or ritual problems, he would prepare an answer. Occasionally, he led a movement or made a suggestion. His leadership was not aggressive, nor did he leave any books as tangible monuments to his scholarship. Another reason why Yisrael Be'er did not play a larger role in public affairs was most probably because there were very few people in America at the time he lived who could appreciate the extent and value of his learning. However, perhaps more importantly, he had a very marked influence on his 9 children. He made sure to give all of them the best Jewish education he could. The result was that all married Jewish spouses, save for one who never married, and were strongly attached to Judaism. This was no small feat in light of the high rate of intermarriage in America during the first part of the 19th century. According to the Asmonean obituary, Yisrael Be'er Khurshid was more than beloved by his family. He was almost idolized. His family devoted themselves to caring for him during the last 2 years of his life when he was ill and suffering. During this period, he was confined to his home, and many came to visit him simply to be in the presence of a man who was a living example of a true Jewish patriarch. He passed away at age 86, surrounded by family and friends. Someone present at his passing, witnessing his serenity of spirit, quote, involuntarily burst out in the words of Scripture, "May I die the death of the righteous, and may my end be like his," unquote. Clearly, Khurshid was an extraordinary man. By the way, one of his sons was Gershon Khurshid, who moved to New Orleans and influenced Judah Turo. Now, Judah Turo had a terrible upbringing as a youth. His life was disrupted after all his father had sided with the British government and was discredited. And when he lived in New Orleans, he wanted really nothing to do with anything Jewish. But Gershom Khurshid worked on him and brought him closer to Judaism. And that's why when you look at the sums of money that he left, You see that at least part of it went to Jewish causes. By the way, it's known as the Touro Synagogue in Newport, not because of Isaac Touro, but because Juro Touro left money for the maintenance of the synagogue and the cemetery. At one point, there were no Jews left living in Newport. The synagogue was closed for a number of years. Yet the funds that Judah Touro had left in his will maintained the synagogue and maintained the cemetery. Thank you.